across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you very much for bearing with me, and thank you to Adam, my webmaster at Creative Hotspot, for bearing with the irregular schedule of these shows lately. Very good reason for that, I'll be able to explain it. It's nothing to do with the show, it's down to me and stuff that's going on with me, but I'll explain all, hopefully, before the end of the year. And thank you for bearing with me through all of this. Going to catch up with some shout-outs soon. Won't be able to do all of them, but I promise that I will get up to speed with the shout-outs very soon. But, you know, I'd like to thank you very much if you have emailed, if you've taken the time and trouble. And when you do email, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show. It's always useful to know. By the way, if you can make a moment, please take part in our survey. Very, very important to us. It's been a couple of years since we last did a survey about listening and listening habits. Go to the website, theunexplained.tv, and you'll find a link to the poll there. And please fill it out. It will only take a couple of minutes, and it will be really useful and helpful to both myself and Adam for planning the future of this show. Thank you very much. As we come to the end of this year, cold in London, foggy today. Hope it's okay where you are. All right, the guest on this edition, very special one and a big supporter of me over the years, Linda Moulton Howe, investigative journalist, well known in America, and a good friend to me. So you're going to hear the latest views of Linda Moulton Howe coming soon. Let's get those shout-outs done. Stephen Spraggs, thank you for the article you sent. Dave Matthews, thank you for the articles that you sent. Somebody whose name I didn't write down, really sorry about this, but you say you'll know who you are. My girlfriend and our friends love listening to your show in snowy Vermont. Especially enjoyed the episode with Jim Oberg. Yes, I liked him. He was good, wasn't he? Merrill in Puyallup, Washington, USA, says, I love your show. Listen while I work the graveyard shift at work. Helps me get through the night. Good to know. Thank you. Eric in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. Favorite guest, Dave Paulides. He will be coming back. Thank you, Eric. Who have we got now? Martin Walsh in Bangkok says, I've sent you a few emails over the years. Once again, I want to thank you for the timeless dedication to The Unexplained. I rarely miss an edition. And I want to suggest the Dyatlov Pass mystery. I'm trying to get something on that because quite a few people have suggested that. Thank you very much, Martin in Bangkok. Brendan White in Cranbourne, Victoria, Australia, said, I'm a big fan of the show. Listen to the podcast every day while helping to build Australia's national broadband network. Good luck with that, Brendan. We're doing the same here. Wish it was a bit faster. Penny Carr says, I'm trying to sort out a friend's Christmas present, trying to be a bit different. Can you send me a photograph? Now, Penny, I have emailed you, but the thing is that no radio station that I work for produces photographs anymore. So I'm going to try and print off one of my own. If I don't do it in the next week or so, please remind me. It's a silly time at the moment. Sherry Moore, thank you for your email. I've addressed the points that you made and have been back to you about that. So thank you very much for being a continued listener here. Nick Rapitoni in Hollywood, California. Great place to be. Wish I could be there now. It says, I wanted to let you know that you entertain me on my weekly commute from Burbank, beautiful downtown Burbank, to Hollywood. I love your interviews, and you fill the gap that was created when Art Bell left the air. Well, who knows? He might be back one of these days, but that's a very kind thing for you to say, Nick Rapitoni. Good to hear from you. Please, can you do me a favour? You'd make me a very happy lady. When you next do shout-outs, would you say hello to Mickey P and Jeffrey Earl, who are both listening? Thank you, Howard. Keep up the superb work. And that comes from, he says, turning the page, Naomi. So, Mickey P, Jeffrey Earl, nice to know you're there, and you too, Naomi. Finally, this time round, Blake Jackson says, so excited to hear a shout-out for CKLW radio station when I was talking to N. Riley Hegarty, who lives in what was the territory of the mighty CKLW. Yes, indeed, the Big Eight in Montreal. I've got recordings of that. I used to get radio recordings when I was a kid. I've never been too much of a British radio person. I took my cues from the great American broadcasters. Yeah, I used to love WABC, CKLW, the Big Eight, and all of those stations, so I would get tapes of them. KHJ back in the day, Los Angeles, and then more lately when I got into talk radio, stations like Kogo in San Diego, WABC, which has now switched to talk, and all of those stations. And as a child in Liverpool, I used to stay up deep into the night. I know I've told this story before, and listen in the darkness hours to American stations that would creep across the Atlantic, and I would go to my mum and dad, who'd be up watching the late movie, and I'd say, listen, mum, this is WABC New York. It would be Dan Ingram or somebody like that. Or what was the other one? KDKA Pittsburgh, which is, I think, the only K station in the W territory because of some business deals done in the past, I think. But, you know, I love North American radio, always have. Sometimes have paid the price for it over here, though, but, you know, got to go your own way, haven't you? Okay, let's get to the guest on this edition. If you want to contact me, by the way, let's just say this, you know, please go to the website, theunexplained.tv, follow the link, and you can send me an email or a donation if you can. And when you get in touch, you know what you have to do. Thank you very much. Linda Moulton Howe from the radio show on Talk Radio a couple of nights ago. Very interesting. We started our conversation by talking about whether there will be disclosure with the change of presidency this time.
Oh, Howard, it is wonderful to be back with you and to give your listeners just a taste of what it was like in the mid-90s to work with Art Bell on the then new Coast to Coast. He would call me up and say, hey, let's do 5 hours on global warming. And I was living in Philadelphia, and that would put me at getting up or getting off the air at 6 a.m., being on the air all night long on the East Coast, and I would do a bullseye of, let's say, 100 different news or labs or some kind of research, and set myself in the middle of this bullseye of all this material, hoping that I had enough to get me through 5 hours. And that was exciting radio, because neither Art nor I really knew what was going to come, either when we were on the air live or from the phones.
It takes a very special person, though, to be able to do that kind of thing. I'm talking about you here, and Art, of course, because he was the guy who steered it. There's still some of this stuff on YouTube if you want to check it out, but not right now. But, you know, you have to be able to string together a narrative, and that, Linda, as we're about to discover, you can do. Now, in this first segment, we've got news coming up at midnight here in the UK, which is, what, 8 minutes away, and we've got a commercial break to go to before that. I want to talk about something that you and I are both very interested in, because every time there's a change of president, for as long as I can remember, there has been a flurry. When we've had the internet, it's been on the internet. If it wasn't on in the internet days, it was on the radio, of people saying, this is going to be the president who will be the game changer. This next president will be the one who opens the files. They said it about Bush. They said it about Bill Clinton. They said it about Obama. They said it a lot about Obama. You and I talked about that. It didn't happen. So we can only assume, can't we, that Mr. Trump is having his briefings about what is in Area 51, about what's been happening since Roswell, perhaps even before that. Do we believe that Mr. Trump will usher in the era that all of these people have been getting so excited about for so many decades?
It's a very good question, Howard, and as you and I talked, I and Grant Cameron and a few of us in the United States and Canada who have had close in, I'm going to say sort of close inside the White House, Washington, DOD area, that we had been being told for at least a year or two or more that it was going to be the president after Obama, that it would certainly be Hillary. And that Hillary Clinton, working with John Podesta, who goes all the way back to Bill Clinton and was Hillary's campaign manager in this most recent election effort, that John Podesta has tried for 10, 15 years to line up what we'll call the pawns on the chessboard of how do we get open the first worldwide headline. We are not alone in this universe. We have never been alone in this universe. And that there are very advanced intelligences out there that have come and gone on this planet and may even have bases here now. All of those words I just said were all part of a discussion going on between John Podesta, Hillary Clinton. She came pretty close with Jimmy Kimmel about 6 or 7 months ago when she was on that program, and Kimmel asked her a question about the UFO field, and was she going to get to the bottom of everything if she were elected? And on that show, late night talk, she said, well, we think that the aliens may have been here, and then she did a caveat, we're not sure, but I can give you the new phrase that they are known by. And instead of saying unidentified, which is the correct first word, she said unexplained aerial phenomena. And it means that somebody had been trying to brief her on unidentified aerial phenomena as being the UK. It is the UK that has led on trying to rename UFOs, perhaps to get the public and the media off their backs from FOIA UFO requests. But nevertheless, she was beginning to use the words that all of us thought. She will be elected. It's finally going to happen. We have even been told by other people behind the scenes just in the last few months that it might have been between November 8th and January 20th, Inauguration Day, that Podesta and Hillary would have opened up with a headline, "We're not alone." Now, with the earthquake in the United States of the Trump election, nobody knows. It's like all bets are off. If a president-elect Trump is briefed on issues that you and I and others have been exposed to for some time, will his reaction be to dismiss? Will his reaction be shock? Will his reaction be the people must be told? Nobody knows. And so, as we now head for January 20th, Howard, I think one of the big growing issues in the United States behind the scenes is, if Hillary and John Podesta were ready to start opening up the truth that there's an alien presence, would Trump slam it down or try to keep it open himself? And none of us, I think, are ever going to have a clue with this new president-elect until he decides on his own, perhaps completely independently from the DOD.
Well, he is an independent speaker, thinker, and actor, as we have seen. It would be fascinating, wouldn't it? I mean, one view of it could be that the man is so keen to break the mold that he might well, for the headlines, for the fact that he will indeed be a game changer, want to be the one who makes that announcement. If it was coming with Hillary, maybe it's still coming with Trump. But as you say, Linda Moulton Howe, in the US, all bets are off. Now, Linda, it's not something we've necessarily prepared for, but you know, you and I have known each other for years, and it's fine if you don't want to talk about this. But I last night, tired as I was after doing a radio show, I watched a documentary on TV. I don't know whether you've seen this series, but there are 1,000 series on air in the United States, and some of them make their way over here. This was the MUFON documentaries, you know, the opening of the MUFON files, the Mutual UFO Reporting Network in the US. And they were talking last night about the far side of the moon and what might be there. I don't know, is that a topic that you've ever looked into?
Yes. I certainly have talked with even a man who was a support tech for the astronauts during the time of Apollo 11. And Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, they were the first, allegedly, to be on the moon. And in just the past few months, I've had an interview with, he's controversial, but in terms of my talking with him for 3 or 4 hours, both on the record, meaning recording, and off the record, and knowing that the person who brought him to the public was Bob Wood, Robert Wood, who is a PhD and was the in aerospace at McDonnell Douglas. Bob Wood I've known since the end of the 80s, and he has been highly credible, highly responsible in all of his work as an aerospace PhD engineer trying to get to the bottom of what is the truth about UFOs, ETs, and what is on this planet, what is in our solar system. And it was Bob Wood working with William Mills Tompkins. He had his 93rd birthday this past spring. And on about his birthday, he and I were doing long recorded phone interview about a new book that he had put out with Bob Wood's collaboration. And why I'm giving you this detail is that you will hear him attacked. You will hear him attacked like Philip J. Corso was attacked, like most of the people who have had a credible military background, if they step out with information that is outside of what is politically acceptable, they really do get attacked. And in this case, the same thing happened. But William Mills Tompkins independently told me something that I had heard privately back in 1990-91 period of time when I was working on a special in Los Angeles called UFO Report Sightings that led to the sighting series in the United States. And this is both his statement and what I heard all the way back to 1990 coming through a friend, a pilot of Neil Armstrong, is that when the Apollo 11 crew were starting to go into the descent into the moon, there was on the public screens, at one point where you think they're getting close to land, there was a lot of dust that came on the screen, and you hear the NASA voice say, they're trying to avoid a rock in the crater where they were going to land. That's what went out publicly. What I was told in 1990 and what William Mills Tompkins told me this year is when the cameras were coming, aiming where they were going to land, NASA had a 7-second delay. So NASA was seeing the images 7 seconds before the public so that they could change, alter, do anything. And according to the pilot, a longtime friend of Neil Armstrong, and to William Mills Tompkins, who served in the Navy, what built models having to do with naval research into unidentified aerial objects, there were 3 lens-shaped silver disks all lined up right on a hill that was framing this crater where they were landing and where the cameras were aimed. And that each of those big lenses were maybe somewhere 100, 200 feet, maybe William Mills Tompkins thought they might even be as big as a football field. That would be a gigantic lineup of silver lens-shaped craft that would have been highly visible in the camera lens as they were coming down into that crater. And that, in the 7-second delay, all of that dust and the NASA voice talking about a rock that they were trying to avoid was, in fact, the 3 huge lens-shaped metallic craft lined up on the hill. Now, that leads, let's just say for now, let's just say that this is fact. This is true. Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, they knew that they were now in the presence of something maybe they were briefed about, maybe they were not. But this ties into other whistleblowers over the last 20 years who have said that they were paid and they were counseled and they were taught how to airbrush structures on the moon, and that the backside of the moon has been basically off limits from any kind of interaction or close photos that would show because there are structures on the backside of the moon. Now, when you come to a general audience and they're hearing this, they haven't been exposed to any of these sentences in what I'll call an official, formal, government, political way. But for those of us who have had off-the-record discussions with people who have worked with astronauts, who have been in counter-intel, who have worked in the military side, and they will tell you that they know for a fact in their exposure to work in having to do with what they call extraterrestrial biological entities, that there has been an alien presence inside and on the backside of our moon for millennia.
This is pretty stirring stuff, and this documentary I saw last night went into a lot of this. Were the astronauts who went to the moon briefed about what they might find or what they might encounter before they went there?
You know, I would love to know the truth. I'll just tell you a little bit more about this pilot who knew Neil Armstrong and tell you I feel that I can talk about it today because Neil Armstrong passed, and we are beginning to get into the half-century mark after Apollo. And I was working as supervising producer on UFO report sightings in Los Angeles. And as I said, this was the early 1990 year. And one of my goals was to try to get as many astronauts as possible on the record with their faces on our camera for a large audience talking about unusual things that they have seen. And one of those interviews was with Pete McDivitt. He had seen a cylinder thing with rods sticking out of it outside of their spacecraft. And he had taken, he said, he thought, he took 30-some photographs of this, reporting it back to the Space Command, and that it was not identified. And he could not wait to get back to find out if anybody knew what this cylinder was that kept seemingly to track them as they were going out toward the moon. And when he did get back, McDivitt, and he said, I want to see my photos, he took them. He was told that he did not have a need to know and to not ask any further. And he told that, us that on camera. So now, among those other people that I was trying to reach, we talked with Gordon Cooper, we talked with Edgar Mitchell, and now I am trying to track down and see if there is any way that we could do an interview with Neil Armstrong as the first person who stepped onto the moon, and I had heard all these rumors before. And so I was led to this pilot who, when we sat down to talk, said that he had known Neil Armstrong in their late teens, early 20s, and that they had been in planes and jets and all of that world together. And he would have thought and considered himself to be one of Neil's closest old friends. And after July 1969, when they returned to Earth after the famous one small step for man, one giant step for mankind on the moon, he called up Neil because he was curious. He told me, he said, you know, I began to realize we weren't seeing much of Neil Armstrong. And I don't know if you have that perspective now, but Howard, but it started after they got back. It became very clear that you were not seeing Neil Armstrong on news shows.
Well, he didn't exactly retreat, but he went into academia, didn't he?
He went out of the public, and you would have thought that he could have spent the rest of his life interfacing with the public in some big way, getting kids into astronaut training, who knows. But he basically disappeared from public interface.
And it always made me think over the years that there maybe have been something that made him want to just get out of it all.
Well, this is what I'm leading to. So I'm sitting talking with his pilot friend about this and why he called him up. And Neil said, yeah, come on over. And he went to Neil Armstrong's house. And he said, Linda, there was not a single photograph, not of the landing on the moon, not even of him in an astronaut uniform. It was as if the house reflected a non-astronaut existence. And when they sat down, finally, and you know how people who are buddies when they're in their teens and their 20s, it's a different relationship than later friendships. This is a much more bonded thing. And he said, he basically I said, Neil, what's up? And he said that his friend looked down at the floor instead of at his eyes. I've never forgotten that. And told the story that I told you a few minutes ago, that there were three large silver disks waiting on the hillside of the crater, and that when the dust came up, it was because they were given an order to turn away. And that he got the distinct impression that night that Neil Armstrong was both dismayed at some level, but wanted to be a good soldier and was going along with the program, even though it was a sense that his old pilot friend had, that he, Neil Armstrong, was basically retreating from any challenge or having to even worry about talking about the fact that there were ETs on the moon when they landed.
So it wasn't a kind of denial, it was more of a way of handling the situation, that he knew something but didn't really want to get involved with living a lie.
Yeah, and he was supposed to be an extremely ethical guy, and people who don't want to lie or don't want to even imply something that is false, I could see how they would retreat from having anything to do or any demands in a really public way, because they would always feel like they were lying.
It is staggering stuff. And one of the other bits of evidence, apparently, is a two-minute, I think it is, piece of radio traffic that was removed from the broadcast that everybody saw around the world at that time. But radio amateurs were able to tune into the transmissions from the moon, and they were able to record this. And that broadcast that was never aired to the public records and documents these things that apparently happened.
And did they specify in the documentary, did they broadcast, did they give a transcript of exactly what was happening in those 2 minutes?
They did, not all of it, but yes, they did, the three silver discs and all the rest of it. And it was, the conversation that was played was very calm. It was a matter-of-fact way of, I mean, obviously, if you're a professional and you're trained to have the right stuff and be up there on the moon, your training tells you to just calmly report what you've seen.
And I think there's something else, though. I really do think that the astronauts were getting briefings during that period of time, the Apollo program. Maybe not all, but some. And that would have been perhaps a difficult, we'll call it a stress, because they would know that there was one huge truth, that the entire planet, the human family, was being denied by our governments and people in power.
Do you think, with the Apollo astronaut era coming to an end, I don't know how many are left now. I know that Buzz Aldrin was down at the South Pole for a special expedition and some science and had to be flown back because his health had deteriorated. There was some problem there, I think, in this last week. You know, we are running out of people who may be able to confirm or deny this, aren't we?
Well, and some of my colleagues and I had started a question among ourselves privately when John Kerry, 2.5 weeks ago, was in the Antarctic at exactly the time of the election. I and a few others said, this doesn't make sense. This is 2 + 2 = 7. The only reason that we could think that John Kerry at that moment in history would be in the Antarctic is because he was interfacing with the alien presence that is supposed to be there and have been there for a long time. And then for Buzz Aldrin, 2 weeks approximately later, to be suddenly, we wouldn't know that he was down in Antarctica if he hadn't had this problem and had to be dispatched out of McMurdo. And it made even more people say, wow, John Kerry and Buzz Aldrin in a two and a half week span are both in the Antarctic when we have had all kinds of whistleblower, we'll say unproven statements you might put them in the rumor category if we don't have documents and a paper trail, but nevertheless, there have been several people who have said we have had an alien presence in the Antarctic region for millennia. And then, this is the question that I have raised in some of my Earth Files reports. If it were true that there is some kind of a large pyramid structure, think of Cheops, only maybe larger, and that it is built on the land surface of Antarctica, when was the last time that scientists think that Antarctica was free of ice? It's not definite, but there is a consensus in the 13 million to 14 million years ago. If it is confirmed that there is a huge pyramidal structure that would be under 2 miles of ice and on land that didn't have any way to have this constructed before 13 to 14 million years ago, Howard, that would be revolutionary because there is no way to explain a large pyramid complex 2 miles under ice in Antarctica unless it is something that built it 13 to 14 million years ago.
Right. Let's talk about Steve Bishop, age 50. His father, Sergeant John Smith, in inverted commas, retrieved dead non-humans at crash sites from 1947 Roswell and beyond for a number of years. This is a fascinating story. I haven't heard anybody else tell this story, and I don't think anybody else would tell it better than you.
Well, thank you. It is becoming intriguing to me every time I do a coast-to-coast AM, for example, when I'm on the air for 3 hours. 2 hours I do produced, each half hour is produced around a story, and then the third hour is open to discussions with me. And throughout, George Norrie and I, we give out my email address for people who might have firsthand information to get in touch with me. And in this case, the Steve Bishop, as I call him, it is not his real name. It was one of those emails that came very soon after I had done a coast show, and he said, talking about my being a tireless journalist and that he trusted me, which I was grateful, and that he too, like you, had started listening to Art Bell going all the way back to around 1995. And then he said, I have been sitting on a major story for decades. This has never been covered. The public has no knowledge of it. I say this because I have been following all these subjects since I was 6 years old, with good reason, and I just turned 50, close quote. Well, I called and talked to him at some length. And when you can talk with somebody for 2 or 3 hours on the phone, and you're not recording, and they can give you all kinds of verse and chapters about their family, their father, you know that you are in the presence, at least, of what I call the substantive, deep family history. That's really important. If people are just calling up to say, I'm just going to try to get on the air, they're not going to have that ability to talk for 2 or 3 hours and provide and send documents, get me a DD-214 that I always ask on military. So all of that happened in this story, getting documents and so forth.
Sorry, what is a DV-214? Is that a military service record?
Yes, in the United States, D as in dog, 214. That is the paper that anybody who has served in the military, even if they had classified work, they have to have DD-214s that will show where they were stationed, what the years when they entered, when they leave, whether it was an honorable or a dishonorable. As a reporter, most reporters that I know, you always ask military people for a DD-214. Those that cannot provide one, they're probably not telling you the truth. Mm-hmm. Those that can provide and provide one in 24, 48 hours, you know that they are talking to you in an honest, credible context. So in this case, I was able to get the father's DD-214, from his mother and Steve Bishop. Now, what I find fascinating is he was a five-year-old boy for the first time when his father began talking to him, the son. And he was born on, Steve Bishop was born on October 17th, 1966. So if he was about 5 years old, that means in the year 1971 was the first that he ever heard his father, with his brother present and his mother present, begin to open up and use the words Roswell, that his work was to pick up dead extraterrestrial bodies and to participate in what the father told the family was, quote, an alien war, close quote, in Greenland. Now, those are kind of like the bullet points. And when you then have only the son, and I did talk with his brother about all of this as well, but you've got the son who is removed from the firsthand father who had passed some time ago. But nevertheless, he was so taken deeply by what his father said as a child that when he became a teenager in his early 20s, he would try to keep talking with his father. So this was not one conversation. This was based on many, many conversations. And he said in the beginning of the interview with me, and this is a quote, "Whenever it comes to anything with the aliens, everything is completely compartmentalized. His job was strictly to go in and grab the bodies and take them out. There were others that would take care of the live ones, and he had seen them too."
So is this a kind of version of plausible deniability? In other words, it's compartmentalized, so everybody has a little part in the story, but no one person knows all of it.
That's right. That is a big part of it. And I have heard so many people in frustration say, "Linda, I opened up one of your books, and I thought that I was working on the United States government's most classified information about extraterrestrials on this planet. And I open up one of your books, and you have illustrations, you have documents, you have maps. You had more information in your book than I had after 23 years of working in the DIA. That is, I'm recounting a direct conversation to me. And so that people listening, the UK does the same thing. If you have classified work and you have to have a certain needs to know, then you can be working in the same floor, maybe even in the same section, but your desk and your office, if it's a cubicle or however it's arranged, you will not be able to talk to the person in the cubicle next to you unless you shared exactly the same need to know and the same pro words and everything that would give you right and access to that information.
We're saying something very big, heavy, and important here, Linda, because this is the key to, if we assume these things are so, this is the key to how it's been possible to keep the lid on so much of this material for so very long.
That's right. Exactly. And it all began in World War II, as I understand. It was your Prime Minister, Churchill, talking with then General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who became president, that they were in a conversation. This ended up in a letter in your UK National Archive about 8 or 9 years ago. And this was a letter that was from the son of a man who served as a security guard to Prime Minister Churchill. And the son sent this letter, and he's a working scientist in the UK now, the son is. And the letter outlined that his father told him, the son, before he died, that his father had personally heard Churchill and Eisenhower discussing the details of a silver disc that was spinning around an RAF fighter. And so think of a RAF fighter that's going fast in the sky, and then something has the ability to start doing rings around that jet that is moving in the sky, there's no human on Earth that could take the G-forces of spinning around a craft that's going at 300 miles an hour, let's say, the jet, and being able to survive, number one. Number two, nobody had such technology, and that this was the subject when the security guard heard Prime Minister Churchill say to General Eisenhower, "We must keep this away from the public and media for at least 50 years, or it will upend the stock markets and religions and on and on." And that the letter that was sent to the UK National Archive, the scientist was basically giving a context for why Churchill and Eisenhower seem to have come to the conclusion that they must keep this as a secret, but it immediately became a top priority in both governments to monitor. And then when these silver disks began to quote-unquote crash in the United States, Europe, and other places around the world, and we started sending out teams like Steve Bishop's father to gather up bodies that were dead, bodies of extraterrestrial biological entities, that is the phrase in those 1940s documents, and some were alive, and one was taken to Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, not far from where I'm sitting talking to you tonight, and that being is described in a document that I was shown at Kirtland Air Force Base on April 9th, 1983, when I was working on an hour special for Home Box Office. And that was entitled Briefing Paper for the President of the United States of America on the Subject of Unidentified Aerial Craft, and it had parentheses UAC. I remember it was the first time that I had seen that acronym. Everything had been UFOs. And later, the UK adds UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, all of these different acronyms, making it more difficult for the public to access information. In that briefing document that I was shown, it laid out about retrievals, just exactly like Steve Bishop is talking about, what his father worked on, that these retrievals in the state of New Mexico were between Roswell and Corona that everybody has heard about. But that was only one landing zone site between July 2nd and July 5th, 1947. There was another more important one that was below Oscura Peak on the White Sands Proving Ground side of Oscura Peak. And that is the wedge-shaped, that's triangular. These were not round. These were not spherical. These were not cylindrical. These were not lens-shaped. These were wedge-shaped. Think of a piece of pie, only flatter and swoopier. That is what came down in Roswell, New Mexico. The flying saucer, quote-unquote, headline that escaped in the Roswell Daily Record, that was because in the June-July period in the United States, people were reporting, quote-unquote, flying saucers. It became one of those quick media words. You put the words UFO or flying saucers out in headlines to capture audience attention. But it didn't matter to the editors back then because they didn't know anything, whether it was cylindrical, whether it was triangular, whether it was spherical. What was it? Well, I'm telling you, these were wedge-shaped. And the one that came down near Oscura Peak on the White Sands Proving Ground was nearly in perfect condition. And then there was a third that came down on the Mescalero Indian Reservation, which would be in going east from Alamogordo, about 30 miles. There were three in those that short period of time. Now, it sounds like from Steve Bishop and his father that at exactly that same time, Steve Bishop's father was being assigned to go to these Roswell cases, but spent the next 20 years of his life going to many other crash sites.
In fact, there's a transcript on your website, and I was printed this off here in highlights. And your question was, you were born 13 years after the end of the Korean War. Your father was doing this work of retrieval of extraterrestrial bodies during that whole period of time, not just the Korean War.
That's right. And that the Korean War was a parallel, and the father really implies that either it was because the Korean War started over something that was related to extraterrestrial presence on this Earth, or the alien presence took advantage of the Korean War to cover up what it was doing in Greenland. And the father told the son and the mother and the Steve Bishop's brother that he was in Greenland when there was war, active war, going on between two different extraterrestrial groups, and that it was quite violent, and that there was lots of death, and that he, the father, was involved in getting dead ET bodies in Greenland during the Korean War, which was between 1951 and 53. Now, I've heard this before. I have heard of other war skirmishes on our planet in which people have talked to me off the record. Sometimes they won't even talk with their voice, so I have to be the person to share information, which no reporter likes to do that. You want to have the people speak for themselves, but you can understand how sensitive some of this material is. And I've had other people say, we know for a fact that X mission in Y country during Z war was to cover up the retrieval of an extraterrestrial craft or many crafts and beings, and that there have been these parallel things going on our planet with people in the military who had a need to know, being completely aware that they are involved with ETs here and now while we're still living on a planet in which all of the power structures for the last 5,000 years have denied to the human family that there is anything in this universe, and we have been crammed in a way into this thinking that we are the only special life, and it's not true. It's never been true. And here is perhaps one of the greatest surprises to me in this interview with Steve Bishop about his father. I had never heard in 37 years of my trying to get to the bottom of animal mutilations, human abductions, government knowledge, all of it. I never heard this before until I talked with Steve Bishop. And that is, his father said that some of the bodies that he was picking up and putting into body bags were over 6 feet tall reptilians. And the father told his family that he never got used to the fear that he, the father, felt as he tried to get the body into a body bag. And the Steve Bishop said his father was a person that no one in the world would have thought could ever have even felt fear. His father was a very taciturn, never flappable, but when he was telling the family about trying to pick up, looking like standing up lizards from the sites wherever they were going, that his father's hands would start to shake. And the family had never seen that, and they knew. And the father said to Steve Bishop at one point that he had never known such fear as being in the presence of one of these reptilian beings. And Steve Bishop said to me, do you think it's possible that there is something in the reptilian ETs that remains alive that humans could detect? I have no idea, but he actually asked me that question. So this means, in this story coming from this father, and I've seen his DD-214, that we're getting a description in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, up somewhere into the 70s, where there have been so many different crashes that they had teams that were constantly going to do collections. And I said to him, I said to Steve Bishop during this interview, long ago in the 80s, I was talking with somebody in law enforcement, and they said to me, you know, there's been too many of these so-called crashes, and we can't help but wonder if it is like a Trojan horse operation, that we're dealing with an alien presence, and it wants to get into the hands and minds of humans, technology that we wouldn't have reached in maybe 500 years if there had not been these, we'll call them crash retrievals, in various parts of the world starting in the 40s, and that maybe the crashes of UFOs, certain bodies in death, certain bodies alive, that it was all strategized like a very sophisticated chess game to put certain technologies in our hands to get us to back engineer, to accelerate the advancement of the human family for reasons that are still not clear to us, but that we may be in this century finally coming to that handshake. Let's hope it's a friendly handshake with at least one of the non-human entities that will finally say, yes, we've been here for a very long time. We know a great deal about this solar system and this galaxy, and we are here to help you. That's what everybody would like to hear.
Linda Moulton Howe is here, and Linda, I hate to curtail you because you are a marvelous spreader out of stories. You tell them quite beautifully, which is why I do not interrupt when you're on. We have got now approximately 7 minutes or so, and I wonder if you can encapsulate this one from earthfiles.com, your famous website. This was published November 28th. Canadian Transportation Safety Board says Lake Ontario UFO in near collision with Porter airliner. That's a big story.
Yes, it is, and it is still unresolved and mysterious. This goes back. I've talked with a man who was in that vicinity and saw some strange lights in the sky at about that same time. But the story is that there was this Porter airliner, and it was very close coming in to what would be the Lake Ontario, going into that part of Canada, and that the pilots didn't even have time to radio, nothing. They just saw, and this is very significant in this story, they saw what they described. At first, they thought it was a big balloon, and the only recourse that they had, because from their point of view as pilots, they took the plane that had several passengers on it. They just went down. And they went, what they thought is that they went under this object. But then there was no object to see after this Porter airline nearly collided, they thought, carrying their passengers. And if the number of passengers, I've just seen again, they were carrying 54. Well, when they finally got down and this started making to the press that this Porter airliner coming in to Toronto would have to take an evasion in the sky within seconds of what they thought was a collision with something that was big and balloon-shaped, that's where it started going. Basically, it's been international news ever since. Now, the next development, after the pilots, and I'm looking at exactly what the pilots said, they were traveling at 280 miles an hour, which is 450 kilometers per hour. And they said nobody knows at this point what happened. It was so quick. But the two pilots essentially just pushed the nose down to get underneath it. We've got our work cut out trying to figure out what this unidentified flying object was. What did the pilots encounter? It definitely was not a bird. It was fairly large and balloon-like object. And the pilots themselves told the Canadian Senior Regional Air Safety Board investigators that they estimated that whatever this round thing was in front of them, it was approximately 3 meters, which would be 9.8 feet in diameter. Now, since that report that was in the period of mid-November, there has now been a release and a report about whether or not this could have been a drone. Well, the Canadian department went and talked with everybody who makes drones. They made a full report, and their conclusion is that there is no existing terrestrial-made drone that matches the round specs at nearly 10 feet that the pilots, both pilots, described.
And we have to remember that the people reporting the sighting are people who are trained to report things in detail.
That's right. They're pilots, and their lives and the passengers' lives depend on those pilots paying attention to everything that is around them and being able to communicate with the air traffic controllers as they were coming into Toronto. But there was this happened so fast that it was basically a radio report while the process was happening. And this is really extraordinary, but the truth is that that area around Lake Ontario, for a century or two, if there was one place, if you said in North America, that has had as many UFO reports as any place that you could name, it would be in that Lake Ontario, Huron, Michigan, the Great Lakes area. And when you go back into the history of what has happened there, I led in my own Earth Files story about the famous Kinross Air Force Base situation. That was over Lake Superior, November 23rd, 1953. And what is so significant is this entire event was tracked by Kinross Air Force Base radar controllers. They had an unidentified target over Lake Superior, and they scramble an F-89C Scorpion jet to go check it out. And the radar controllers, they keep watching as the F-89 and its two-man crew start approaching on radar to the UFO that caught the radar controllers' attention in the first place. And then, to their amazement, the UFO blip and the F-89 blip on the radar screens merged. The jet and that crew were never found. And the speculation is that whatever this UFO was, it was able to engulf, abduct the F-89.
Swallow it, effectively.
Took it somehow, somewhere, another dimension. I mean, here we get into humans need paper trails, proof, all sorts of firsthand physical forensics to say, okay, this is what happened. When you come to this whole huge history of this planet in which government whistleblowers say that we have had an alien presence with conflicts, geopolitical territorial interests that have been in conflict on this planet for at least 270 million years. That has been said to me eye to eye by a man who retired from the Defense Intelligence Agency, and his job for 23 years, as he said, was to monitor and analyze the geopolitical territorial conflicts of three competing extraterrestrial biological civilizations using this planet as a laboratory. That's a direct quote. Well, 270 million years is before the time of the dinosaurs. So we're talking about the possibility that there has been, when we use that term alien presence, it's a catch-all. How many? What agendas? I can't delineate. But an alien presence that has been mixing and matching genetic material and mining from this planet since before the time of the dinosaurs. And Howard, if the story is that big, then I don't think that the human family is going to have any trouble hearing it. I think it's way past time for governments to keep all of this from us while they're making decisions constantly behind the matrix on information that we have been denied.
Linda Moulton Howe, always fascinating. And Linda, I'd just like to say to you two things. Number one, thank you for supporting me and my work over more than 12 years now. It's been a pleasure and an experience to know you. And number two, from me here in London to you there in New Mexico, happy holidays.
God bless you, Howard, and all of your listeners.
Linda Moulton Howe, don't forget her website is earthfiles.com. And thank you, Linda, very much for supporting me. More great guests coming soon here at The Unexplained as we move through the winter months. Please get in touch. Go to the website, theunexplained.tv. Follow the link. Send me a message if you can and a donation if you're able to. But until next we meet here on The Unexplained, please stay safe, stay calm, and above all, stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.